Well, everybody, I'm sure, knows Tom Young. He's our lead appellate counsel for the Guardian Ad Litem program. He has over 17 years of experience. He's admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Courts of Appeal for the 10th and 11th Circuits, and admitted to practice in Florida, Kansas, and New Mexico. He's argued cases in the Supreme Courts of Florida and Kansas, and has had appellate cases in all five Florida District Courts of Appeal. So today we're going to talk about proving nexus.
Okay, all right, Liz. Thank you very much. Everyone, thanks for joining us. We'll probably have lots of time at the end of the presentation for questions. So I should add that I believe several of our appellate attorneys will be on the call as well. So if any of you have questions about nexus, want clarification about something I've said, or just want to talk about the application of the doctrine in a particular context that maybe I haven't addressed, please be sure to hang on the line, and we'll talk about those following my comments, because I don't expect the comments to take the full time. As Liz announced, our continuing education topic for today is generally labeled proving nexus. I think many of us view this requirement of nexus as a recent phenomenon, but in reality, Florida appellate courts have been overturning dependency and termination of parental rights adjudications for failure to prove nexus since at least the 1980s. So it's been around a long time. The Florida Supreme Court has addressed the issue three times since 1991, most recently in 2004, and I'll give you those cases in a bit. Yet despite all of this abundant case law, we're still finding cases that find their way to adjudication without the nexus evidence and findings necessary to sustain them. And I think it's important to point out those two elements, evidence and findings. There may be times when there's evidence, but the attorneys haven't argued it and the court hasn't made specific findings, and an order that doesn't contain enough findings will be reversed, just as a case that doesn't have any evidence to support findings that are made. So it's important to keep an eye on both of those elements. The goal for the call today is to demystify nexus so that all of our attorneys and witnesses have a clear understanding of what nexus is and understand why proof of nexus is required, and so that everyone is equipped to provide that proof, especially when the department is not. At the outset, I'd like to start with a basic definition. The word nexus comes from the Latin word nectere, and that word meant or means to tie or bind. So the modern definition of nexus is, quote, a connection or link between things, persons, or events, especially that is or is part of a chain of causation, end quote. So it's a link between things. It's a link between parental conduct on the one hand and harm to the child on the other. In the context of Chapter 39, the courts have called nexus a predictive relationship between the abuse of one child and any prospective abuse of another child. And another phrase that we see often, and probably many of us, and I know it was true of me previously, is that the phrase substantial risk of significant harm is also another way of talking about nexus. So when you see that phrase, substantial risk of significant harm, what you need to keep in mind is that the court there is talking about nexus. Now, just as important as understanding the definition of nexus is understanding what nexus is not. Nexus is not a generalized conclusion that parents lack requisite skills to raise a child. Nexus is also not a generalized failure to accept responsibility for a past misdeed. These things actually come from cases where arguments have been made that, the substantial risk of the significant risk of harm to the child is that the parents don't have the skills to be a parent. That sort of generalized conclusion will not support a nexus finding. The evidence has to be much more specific. So the essential point to remember is this. Nexus requires proof of how conduct that is not directed at the child in question nevertheless directly harms the child or directly creates a substantial risk of significant harm. The proof needs to be something tangible. It cannot be speculation, conjecture, or generalized concern. Just a few minutes ago, and it's not a specific case, a specific nexus case, but just a few minutes ago, I circulated a new opinion that was released by the First District yesterday, and I cringe when I read part of it for the same reason I cringe every time I hear someone say that they have a concern. More times than not, concern, quote-unquote concern, is code word for I don't have any evidence, but you need to trust me and do what I'm asking. Hunches and instinct are important, but only in a limited way. And when they're not supported by evidence, they will not be sufficient to support or prove nexus. You've got to have evidence. You've got to have more than a concern. So now, where does nexus come from, and why is it such a big deal in Florida case law? In a nutshell, nexus is a judicially created element that is grafted onto statutory grounds for dependency and termination of parental rights. In other words, it's part of the statutory element, even though if you read the statute, you don't see it. It's judicially created and grafted onto the statute in order to narrow application of the statute, in order to preserve the statute's constitutionality. The government may not interfere with a parent's rights unless the government's action is necessary to protect the child from harm and the action is narrowly tailored. So a statute that is broader than necessary to protect children from harm is an unconstitutional invasion of the fundamental rights of parents. Most of you will recognize this as another application of strict scrutiny, the substantive due process strict scrutiny test. So, in short, nexus is a big deal because without it, we wouldn't be able to terminate parental rights for continuing involvement under 806.1c, for egregious conduct under 806.1f, for murder or voluntary manslaughter of another child under 806.1h, or for prior involuntary termination of parental rights under 806.1i. And, of course, again, this applies to dependency, not just termination of parental rights cases. And there may be nexus requirements under other statutes as well. Those are just a few examples. By reading the nexus requirement into these statutes, even though the requirement does not appear on the face of the statutes, the courts basically are saying we're going to save the statutes from the junk heap of unconstitutionality so that we can affirm adjudications of dependency and termination of parental rights where there is substantial admissible evidence that establishes the prima facie evidence for dependency or termination. Another question that probably comes up frequently is when does the nexus requirement apply? And again, nexus must be proven in dependency and termination of parental rights cases any time a child has not been the direct victim of abuse, neglect, or abandonment. If you have a case that has at least one unabused child, you've got a nexus issue that you better be prepared to address. Nexus must be proven in cases where one child is abused and others are not, and nexus must be proven in cases where parents are bad actors, but their bad acts are not necessarily aimed directly at the children, such as cases involving domestic violence, cases involving substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and murder manslaughter cases. And again, there are others, but these are just a few examples. Let me give you some specific facts specific examples illustrating when proof of nexus is required or not required. And I've got five here. The first one involves a case involving one child. This child is found malnourished and with bruises, scars, and old fractures. In this case, no nexus element will be required because this child has been abused and neglected. So you have direct proof of abuse and neglect, and therefore you don't need a further demonstration of nexus. Let's tweak that, though, in the second example. You still have this one child. Let's say this child's the mother's son, and he is found malnourished and with bruises, scars, and old fractures. The mother and her paramour have a second child, a girl, who is 2 years old. And when the department investigates the abuse report concerning the boy, finds this two-year-old girl to be healthy and by all appearances free from abuse. In this particular case, no proof of nexus is required as to the boy, but nexus must be proven as to the girl because the girl has not been abused. So any action the state is taking to protect her is to protect her from prospective abuse. The state must prove as part of its dependency petition why it is now likely that this girl, who has not been abused for the first 2 years of her life, is now likely to be abused by the mother or the father. Here's another example. We have two children, and the mom and the children are out of town for a few days. While they're away, the dad uses drugs in the home and ends up killing another person in the home. Here again, nexus must be proven. Unless you have direct evidence of abuse of the children, the father's egregious conduct of murdering someone in the family home poses only prospective abuse or neglect, and you're not going to be able to sustain dependency or termination of with regard to that father without proof of nexus. A fourth example I'll give you comes up from time to time where dad kills the mom. Here again, without direct evidence of abuse to the child, you have to prove nexus. If there is no evidence that the child has been abused, any abuse or neglect is prospective only. And the fact that the father killed the mother will not sustain a termination of parental rights without proof of nexus. A high-profile case that is currently playing out in the media is the Tennessee case where the minister's wife shot the minister while he slept. If you recall, she was convicted only of voluntary manslaughter and the criminal charges, and she's now out of prison. Her deceased husband's parents, her in-laws, are wanting Tennessee courts to terminate her parental rights, and recently she was given visitation with her three daughters. Speaking for myself only, I find that I have a different reaction to the case in Tennessee where the killer was a domestic violence victim than I do cases like the one that was recently decided by the Second District here in Florida where the father put the gun to the mother's head and pulled the trigger. But the bottom line is, in Florida, the visceral reaction of me or anyone else is irrelevant. The rule of law in those cases is the same, that you have to prove a nexus between the conduct of the parent and prospective abuse of the children, regardless of whether the killer is the victim of domestic violence or the perpetrator of domestic violence. Then a fifth example that we see from time to time is that of sex abuse. Let's say we have a man who sexually abuses his 10-year-old stepdaughter. He also has a 7-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son in the home. In this particular circumstance, you're not going to be able to adjudicate the other children dependent or to terminate the father's parental rights to those children without proof of nexus because there is no evidence that either of those children have been abused or neglected. again, where does this case law originate? And the short answer to that question is, frankly, every appellate court in Florida. Every district court of appeal has imposed a nexus requirement on one statute or another, or under one subsection of a statute or another, at some point in time. Every once in a while, you'll find conflict among the districts on certain points, but the essential thing to remember is that they all have imposed nexus under one requirement or another. And I think most important for today's discussion is the fact that the Florida Supreme Court has imposed a nexus requirement every time the issue has come before that court. The three leading nexus cases from the Florida Supreme Court are, the first one is Padgett, and you're probably all familiar with Padgett from our least restrictive means analysis in connection with provision of case plans. That's Padgett versus Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services, 577 Southern 2nd, 565. That's a 1991 decision. And the Florida Supreme Court imposed a nexus requirement in dependency cases in the case in the 2000 case, N. Ray M. F. And that's at 770 Southern 2nd, 1189. And then most recently, and this was a case Dennis Moore was involved in, Department of Children and Family Services versus FL, 880 Southern 2nd, 602. And again, that's a Florida Supreme Court decision from 2004. In FL, the 4th District Court of Appeal had declared unconstitutional the provision that allows termination of parental rights when the parents have previously had their parental rights terminated involuntarily. The Supreme Court of Florida reversed the 4th District and said this ground for termination is constitutional, but only if nexus is proven. FL provides an excellent overview of why proof of nexus is constitutionally required, and it actually goes in and talks about Padgett and MF, the two prior cases, and expands them a bit. And although FL technically only was addressing the constitutionality of Section 39806(1)(i), which again is termination premised on prior involuntary termination, the rationale of its application is much broader, and that is simply that the trial court's decision may not be based on any single act or omission, but must be based on the totality of the circumstances surrounding the child who has not been yet abused or neglected. So again, to emphasize that point, and this is a critical point under current Supreme Court precedent, when proof of nexus is required, the trial court's decision may not be based on any one fact. It has to be based instead on the totality of the circumstances surrounding the child who has not yet suffered abuse or neglect. Now, this does not mean that we have to sit around and wait until a child is abused. There's plenty of case law that says that's not the case. I think, in fact, Padgett talks about that and quotes some district court case law. What it means is that the totality of the circumstances have to demonstrate that the child has been harmed by the parent's conduct or that future harm is likely. So that brings us then to the question of what constitutes proof of harm or a substantial risk of significant future harm. Hillary Camber, one of our appellate attorneys, calls this connecting the dots between the bad behavior of the parent and the effect on the child. I think the easiest way to find harm is to just ask yourself and your witnesses, how has the parent's conduct negatively affected the child? If you nor your witnesses can articulate an objective effect on the child, then I would submit that you ask a second question. That is, how does the parent's conduct make it likely or probable that the child will suffer harm if the trial court does not adjudicate the child dependent or terminate the parent's rights? Again, if you cannot answer either of these questions with some objective statements and some objective proof, you probably do not have sufficient evidence to prove nexus, and you need to regroup and reevaluate your case and your options. If you can answer the question, then you just simply need to present the witnesses and the evidence that breathe life into your answer and that illustrate your answer. So again, I want to emphasize that unspecific concern or fear, and how many times have we heard those words, I'm concerned or I'm afraid that, these things are not evidence. They are not evidence of nexus, and they will not carry the day for you. The evidence must point to something definitive and may very well require that you go out and get an expert to link past conduct to the future harm. Now, proving nexus may be easier in some cases than in others. To give you an example, Dawn Marie recently shared with me a 911 recording of a young girl reporting a domestic violence incident. It was a riveting recording. There was no doubt upon hearing that recording that that child and every child in the home was affected by the domestic violence that was going on in that home. And in a case like that, admitting the recording into evidence would be sufficient, I believe, to establish nexus. Even without that or another 911 recording, evidence that a child was crying and upset when the police arrived would be some evidence of nexus, even though we might not traditionally think of that as harm, because it demonstrates a link between the parent's conduct and a negative effect on the child. So again, you just have to stop and ask yourself questions. How is it affecting the child? And then articulate all the things, and then rally all the evidence that illustrates what you've been able to articulate. In substance abuse and domestic violence cases, the nexus to neglect might be proving that indicators like bedwetting, poor school performance, and reclusiveness disappeared when children are placed in appropriate homes. For instance, you may have a GAL who reports that, you know, when I first met the child, they were afraid of their shadow, they wouldn't talk to me, they wouldn't talk to anyone, they stayed over in a corner, and now, 6 months later, they're vibrant, they're engaging, and they're thriving. This, again, could be evidence of nexus between what was going on in the home and the effect on the child. You may need expert testimony to bolster it, but those sorts of things may be the evidence you need. Guardian ad litem team members are in an excellent position to provide these sorts of facts and testimony, but also to identify additional witnesses. You don't want to get into a hearsay situation, but the guardian ad litem may not only have facts that they can testify to, but they can identify for you additional witnesses that will be vital in establishing the nexus, because these are the folks who are out there talking to educators, caregivers, and others who have firsthand knowledge of what the child is exhibiting and what the child is exhibiting before and after. I want to go over a few factors that I've noticed in some of the case law that have been approved as establishing harm or a substantial risk of future harm. These include, as I've touched on, behavioral problems, nightmares, and fear in children. If you can link those to what was going on in the home, there is your proof of nexus. Sometimes you can do that through layperson testimony. Other times you'll need an expert. A parent's relapse following drug or alcohol abuse treatment may be enough to establish a nexus to substantial risk of future harm. Continuing living arrangements that caused or contributed to the harm of another child may be proof of nexus. Continuing a lifestyle or continuing a relationship that was involved in causing or contributing to harm of another child could possibly provide your nexus evidence. failure of a parent to visit or support an unabused child while they're out of the home could be proof of nexus that you might not normally think of. And while I said earlier that a statement that a parent lacks the ability to parent is not proof of nexus, if you can provide a real-life example of a parent's inability to parent, something that has been observed in a supervised visitation or so forth, that could provide evidence of nexus. Factors that would require expert testimony but that would establish nexus include establishing that parental conduct has had a psychological impact on the unabused child. As I said before, that could be bedwetting or nightmares and so forth, or it could be something more intangible like post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, attachment disorders, and so forth. These, again, would require expert testimony, but would definitely establish the nexus you need. Other expert testimony that will establish nexus is proof that the parent's condition is beyond the parent's control. This could be cases like mental illness, cases involving parents with developmental disabilities, could involve pedophiles who are abusing children, could involve parents with addictions. Proof that the parent's conduct or condition is likely to continue requires expert testimony usually, but again, establishes the nexus. And proof that conduct or the parent's condition is documented in professional literature to pose increased risks of harm to children would establish nexus. And finally, any proof that the parent's conduct or condition makes caring for the child impossible would establish your nexus. In this regard, with these expert factors, I recall a recent case where the parent was developmentally disabled, and in that particular case, the expert did an excellent job of establishing all four of the things I just talked about. In that case, the expert was able to testify that the mother had a cognitive disability. She had a congenital disability that was causing her brain matter to calcify. She had never abused her child. And although she was low functioning, she could articulate the things she needed to do to be a good parent. But the expert was able to testify that her condition was not only beyond her control, but that it was going to continue, it was going to deteriorate, and that medical literature documented that people with this condition had trouble executing what they knew they needed to do, even when they knew they needed to do it and wanted to do it, that this condition prevented them at times from even executing simple tasks like feeding a child. So in that particular case, the expert provided excellent nexus testimony, and really made the difference between a case that would have been reversed for provision of a case plan and a case that had very solid nexus evidence concerning prospective abuse. Finally, the case law emphasizes that certain kinds of evidence concerning the totality of the circumstances are most important. So when you're presenting and arguing a nexus case, it is important to emphasize these points that have shown up repeatedly in decisions of the Supreme Court and the Courts of Appeal. And those are six factors. First of all, similarity between the parent's prior conduct and the circumstances surrounding the current unabused child. If you can demonstrate similarity of circumstances, that is some proof of nexus that needs to be particularly emphasized. Similarities between the abused child and the unabused child are important, such as age, relationship, and gender. If you're dealing in a sex abuse case and all the children are girls, you're going to have a better chance of establishing nexus than if some of them are boys. So emphasizing that these are all girls, that they all have the same relationship to the abuser, that they're all similar age, will help you establish that nexus connection. Close proximity in time between prior conduct and the circumstances of the unabused child should be emphasized. And treatment that the parent received or, frankly, has not received after the prior conduct and any relapses, again, is critical evidence to emphasize. And, of course, again, testimony and evidence that circumstances have not changed are important. And then finally, the expert testimony. Anytime you're dealing with an unbiased third-party witness, by all means, you should use that evidence for all it's worth. Because the guardian ad litem witnesses, the department witnesses, usually are considered to be biased. And so if, and of course, all witnesses are biased for their side, that's normal and natural. But if you've got the benefit of someone who is more objective, you should use that for all it's worth. Teachers and daycare providers and so forth, as well as experts. So that leads me to the conclusion, and that's simply this. For purposes of guardian ad litem trial practice, I think you should assume that proof of nexus is required in every case involving a child who has not suffered actual abuse or neglect. Your case will not be reversed for proving nexus where you didn't need to prove it, but the failure to prove nexus will always increase the chance for reversal. So if you have a case that involves a child who has not been actually abused or neglected, and you have a nexus issue that needs to be addressed. If you find yourself questioning your ability to prove a link between parental conduct and actual harm, or a link between parental conduct and the substantial risk of significant future harm, you need to staff the case internally with your supervising attorney and the GAL team in order to reassess the evidence and the options available. I think you may find often that there's ample evidence and it's just a matter of your lay witnesses not understanding what evidence you actually need. And once you explain to them what you need, they're like, oh, well, here. So the staffing can be critical in helping you put that together. If after you've done the staffing, your concerns persist, then talk to your supervising attorney about contacting the regional attorney and or the appellate team. We're always happy to help where we can in developing trial strategy. And, of course, when you're doing your staffings, if you have the time and you have the relationship and have the opportunity to include the DCF attorney and or other witnesses outside the guardian ad litem team, that's something I strongly recommend that you do. The worst thing that a guardian ad litem attorney can do in these cases is to be unprepared to prove the nexus element, to be unprepared or even worse, to be unaware of the need to prove the nexus element. Reversal is going to be virtually assured when a favorable trial court ruling is not supported, number one, by specific evidence, and number two, by specific findings of fact in the order establishing a link between parental conduct and the harm or significant risk of future harm. You all know from experience that reversal can negatively impact children emotionally because of the changing in placements and circumstances that may follow that reversal. I want to close my formal presentation now with a quote from an opinion that was released by the Third District earlier this year. That quote is this: "We recognize the extraordinary responsibility the legislature has reposed in DCF to intervene to provide for the care, safety, and protection of the children of this state when statutorily required. However, it is also well settled that a parent has a fundamental liberty interest in the care, custody, and management of his or her child. For this reason, DCF must, like any other litigant, be prepared to properly plead and prove its case when a parent contests its proposed action. Because DCF failed to meet its fundamental legal obligation in this regard in this case, we reverse the adjudication of dependency below. Now, although the court in that case was speaking in terms of the department, it applies absolutely equally to the guardian ad litem program. Our job as GAL attorneys is to make sure that what the program believes is best for the child is ordered in the lower court and affirmed on appeal. And that means that we must be prepared to prove nexus even when the department is not. And I think this quote stands as a stark reminder that we're dealing with litigation. We're dealing with burdens of proof. And although we may all know what's best for the child, if we do not prove our case, what's best for the child is not relevant because the case will be reversed. We're lawyers. We deal with evidence. We deal with burdens of proof. And it's our responsibility to know and understand what we need to prove, what quality that evidence needs to be, and to get it into the record. So with that, let me say thank you for joining today's call.